Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Artist on Air, where I am thrilled to have Lucille Cornet with me, a recognized leader in the vertical SaaS space. With a decade of experience at 8Roads, a global venture capital firm managing $11 billion in assets, Lucille has been instrumental in identifying and scaling groundbreaking vertical SaaS companies like Toast, Lighthouse, or Hero Software. Her expertise spans across industry from hospitality to wellness, helping niche software businesses becoming market leaders. So today, she is sharing her most valuable learnings on how to build a 100 million ARR vertical SaaS company. You will hear why becoming multi-product is super essential, how to increase your ACVs significantly over time, which role embedded financial products can play for a vertical SaaS platform, and how to leverage communities within your niche. 50 minutes full of valuable insights and learnings. So let's go.
Artist on Air, der SaaS-Podcast für den deutschsprachigen Raum. Wertvolle Tipps von erfolgreichen Gründern, Top-Investoren und führenden Industriepartnern, die euch bei der Skalierung eures Unternehmens schnell und unkompliziert weiterhelfen. Zusammengestellt von Janis Bandorski, Julius Göllner und Matthias Ernst.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, from rainy Berlin today. And I have the pleasure talking to Lucille today. Lucille, good morning.
Morning, Julius.
You have the pleasure not being here at the rainy, gray Berlin. You're in London. I'm not sure if the weather is better, but like based on your energy and the smile I'm looking into, you had a great morning and start to the day.
It's sunny inside, exactly.
Sunny inside. Very good to hear. And I think a good base for our conversation today. But before we start and go into vertical SaaS today, Lucille, tell me about you a little bit yourself. And of course, what are you doing?
Yes, happy to. So I'm a partner at 8Roads, as you know, and we're a global VC firm with offices across the globe. So US, Asia, Europe. In Europe, the whole team is based in London, but we invest all across Europe. And as you can probably hear, I'm French originally. We're very focused on scale ups, so we can do anything from Series A, B, C, and across sectors as well. But as I'll probably, spoil a little bit the topic of today, but I do spend a lot of my time on vertical SaaS and fintech. So those are the areas where I spend most of my time. In terms of me personally, I've been an investor for 13 years now and at 8Roads for 10.
Where's the passion for vertical SaaS coming from, Lucille? Because if we take a look on the last 10, 12 years in SaaS, probably there was a lot of horizontal plays, a lot of interest and curiosity about this. So where is your passion coming from?
Well, you know, one thing I find interesting in this job, and I feel very fortunate to be a venture investor because it's a job where you learn all the time. And I think one thing in particular that I've definitely learned is the more I do this job, the more I unlearn what people told me. And so there are a lot of blanket statements people love to make when you enter venture capital, right? So horizontal markets are larger, it's easier to build large companies there. And we'll probably talk about other cliches like that, but you know, you should always hire very experienced executives and so on. And I think now having been doing this job for 13 years, I try to unlearn a lot of these patterns because every company is different and we keep learning all the time. The market changes extremely quickly, obviously, AI at the moment, many other trends. And so coming back to your question, I think vertical SaaS has been a bit of an afterthought for so many years, right? People thought the big categories are going to be HR, they're going to be marketing, they're going to be all these, CRM. And obviously, gigantic and very exciting companies have been built. We're investors in Hibob, for example, which is a fantastic company in the HR space. However, when you look at the economy, there are just a lot of small businesses, in particular in Europe. And I think for a long time, these have been a little bit overlooked in terms of technology adoption and innovation. And I think it's really interesting now to look at that opportunity and say, all these small restaurants, all these small hotels, all these small gyms, they're going to adopt technology and probably leapfrog a lot of the innovations that we've seen in larger enterprise. And that opportunity is just gigantic, right? And so that's probably where the excitement comes from. Obviously, the other thing that has happened is now you start to see a lot of success stories in vertical. And, you know, obviously, ServiceTitan just filed their S1 to IPO this week. But, you know, companies like Toast that we were fortunate to back in the US, in our US team, which is now like close to 25 billion market cap, really show that these companies can become actually pretty big. And, you know, both ServiceTitan, which, you know, we'll see how they IPO, but probably anywhere between 7 and 8 billion market cap, and Toast are just US, right? Mostly US. So it just shows one single country, one single vertical can really build very large companies. And so that gets us excited.
So here in DACH, we also have kind of a large market, at least in Europe. And I know, Lucille, you also did an investment in a vertical SaaS company recently in Germany here. So maybe to give a little bit of an explanation what vertical SaaS really means for our listeners, because definitions can be broad. Who did you invest into and what are they doing?
Yes, we invested very recently in a company called Hero Software that you had on the pod recently. And they're effectively a software company providing an all-in-one tool for tradespeople. So think electricians, photovoltaic installers, plumbers, all these SMBs in Germany. And Hero is going to provide the all-in-one software, originally basically doing ERP invoicing, but increasingly things like managing staff, managing inventory, managing payments for these small businesses. And maybe to broaden the definition about vertical SaaS, when I talk about vertical SaaS, I'm mostly speaking about SMB, yeah. Vertical SaaS, which is an important definition because obviously vertical SaaS is everything that's not horizontal. So you could also argue insurance tech, healthcare tech, all of fintech arguably is vertical SaaS. So for, you know, generally when I talk about vertical SaaS, I mean specifically the one servicing the SMB part of the economy. So, you know, call it ACV that are below 50K, servicing like businesses that are below, you know, 200 FTEs, right? That's what I have in mind.
What made Hero Software an attractive target for you, Vasilia? So you're seeing a lot. We are operating here in Germany and a few other European markets. I think Hero did some tests, but also like on a very low level, not in the US. So give us a little bit of a reasoning why you provided funding for Hero.
Yes. So you have understood we love the thesis of vertical SaaS, first of all, right? So we've been on the lookout for these companies. And in fact, we're just also doing our own competition of vertical SaaS companies called EU Vertical SaaS 50 that is going to be published in a couple of weeks with our friends from Altitude, which is an early stage fund in Germany. So we're always on the lookout for those companies. I think a couple of things, right? So obviously we look at the end market and some end markets are more attractive than others. So the size, obviously, of the market, but also how healthy is that market? Specifically, if we talk about Hero, actually, especially in Germany, the tradespeople are very healthy, right? Very resilient, bigger companies than people think. So it's funny when I did the investment, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, like they imagine the single, you know, one freelancer, plumber, but actually it's not that, right? Like you have very sizable SMBs, you know, very professionalized, 100 employees running their own marketing campaigns, right? So there are a lot of those. And so we think it's a healthy part of the market. I think the second thing that we find very exciting, and that's probably true of all of Europe, is there is a big generational change at the moment in these companies. And we see that also in the hotel space where you have basically this generation of, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old people that are going into retirement, and they're either selling or transmitting those companies to younger people who don't know on-prem, don't even know desktops, right? Want something on mobile. They don't understand why payments are not integrated. They don't want to, install a software and have like maintenance services. All of that is foreign for our new generation. And that is, I think, a big trigger of change because you have this new young workforce effectively coming in and saying, this is madness, right? Like, why are we operating on-prem? Why is it so slow? You know, to give you another example, a lot of the systems take a lot of training because they're not very intuitive. And those are industries with a lot of turnover, right? So if you operate a restaurant, a hotel, there would probably be 20, 30% of your workforce that changes every year. And every time someone else joins, like new receptionist, 3 weeks of training about the system, this is just not sustainable, right? And people are used to consumer apps, neobanks, they're used to everything on their phone. And I think that creates this demand for something way more intuitive, way easier to operate in their day-to-day business operation. So that's a big trigger. I think probably the last thing, and coming back also on Hero specifically, is big staffing shortages, right? And I don't want to go into politics, but, you know, I don't know if it's the same in Germany, in France as well. Like, a lot of people have been pushed into secondary studies. No one is doing, you know, like craft and trades job. Like, they weren't seen attractive for many generations. I don't know why. I think it's a mistake. But long story short, there's just very few of these qualified trades in the market. And so, again, that pushes for automation, because if you have that workforce, you don't want them to be spending the time reconciling invoicing, right? Like, you want them to be at the sites, on the construction sites, at the customer. And everything you can do as a business owner to automate, you know, reconciling payments, pushing invoices, booking visits, producing quotes, I think becomes a worthwhile investment. And our deep belief is that is going to keep increasing, right? That problem of staff shortages, and, you know, especially for skilled workers, and the fact that you will want to automate as much as possible everything that's not core in their day-to-day.
This is an advertisement. VC financing is a great way to scale a company very quickly, but it's not the only source of capital. That's why today I'd like to remind you of our partner, Float. Float is an experienced and reliable partner for financing SaaS companies. Whether you want to extend your cash runway or invest in growth, Float offers flexible financing options for all your needs. And above all, Float is straightforward. They say onboarding is super easy, and you get access to a line of credit that you can then use as you need it. And you only pay for what you actually use, so there's no additional costs. Float also makes your financing an absolutely personal experience. You talk to real people who listen to you and can respond to you individually, not just automated systems. If you're looking for a financing partner who understands your needs, you can meet Yannis, Cedric, and the team at many of our events. Or you just drop Yannis an email at yannis@gofloat.io. However, I could simply run through online what this would look like in your specific case. Visit gofloat.io and try the calculator there to run through your options.
Automation, I think, is a point which is also familiar to me. The opportunity of the generational change in terms of penetration of the software is a quite interesting one for me. So thanks for sharing the thought here, Lucille. I think you gain a lot of learnings in investing in vertical SaaS companies and accompanying them until like super late stage up to IPO. So I'd like to really dive into your learnings in vertical SaaS, and I'd like to provide them to our listeners, because there are probably many of them also working on vertical operating systems. So maybe we can start with the first one, which I have read in one of your famous articles, also available on LinkedIn, is becoming a multi-product company is essential, which I suppose is like starting with a certain use case, but then really extending on the product side. But what's especially behind this kind of learning you mentioned?
Yes, it's a great one to start with. I think in the beginning you asked, you know, why has vertical SaaS been a bit overlooked? Yeah. And I think the initial fear or hesitation that a lot of investors had is small ACVs means you need a lot of customers, right? It's just very simple math. If you're going to sell for 1K, 2K, those are small ACVs, right? you're gonna like if you keep growing, you need to add a lot of logos, right?
Yeah, and you need a super efficient acquisition engine then, yeah?
So a good acquisition engine, which is hard to scale and all that stuff. And I think that's where, obviously, when you look at success stories like ServiceTitan, like Doctolib and others, it's not that they become, you know, like so many logos. What they've done is obviously increase ACVs. And so the whole thesis of Vertical SaaS is that once you have a big base of customers, you can sell more to them. And so that goes back to your question around multi-product. It's crucial for these companies to become multi-product and add to their portfolio of offerings to be able to take a bigger share effectively of the spend of these companies. And it was interesting because I mentioned, so ServiceTitan just filed their S1 this week. So I spent time nerding around looking at all their financials. And I was actually amazed that their ACV is 80,000, which is gigantic for an SME vertical SaaS. Obviously, you can make the argument that in the US, they're probably SMBs that are probably larger than what we have in Europe. But I think the interesting point here is really they've expanded their product offering massively. And when you look at them, like they stayed pretty focused geographically. So they're just US and Canada. They stayed pretty focused in their vertical. So if you look at it, they stayed like they're also just doing tradespeople, right? So, you know, plumbers, carpenters, HVAC installers. However, they really have grown their product offering. And so they do anything from lead generation, scheduling, dispatching of workforce. They do HR tech. They do lending. They do payments. And that's clearly how they've managed to have like that large of an ACV. But if you look at them, they're 8,000 customers. So it's actually not that many. So not that many logos and large ACVs. And I think that's clearly the lesson you're referring to, which is you need to be able to build that suite of products and keep effectively upselling your base.
Two questions, especially to this, Lucille, like having an 80K ACV. Do you have an idea where they have been coming from? So what was the ACV a couple of years ago? And maybe also like what's their first 12 months ACV, the first year's ACV? Because I guess like a SMB will probably not start with the 80K. They will probably start with one or two modules and then NRR is quite high and you're moving up to it. So any numbers around this?
I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly on ServiceTitan specifically, but clearly you're absolutely right. Right, they didn't start there. I think one interesting point that I spend a lot of time thinking about is where is that ACV coming from as well, and that's another thing where initially, you know, one limitation is you're thinking an SMB is never gonna spend like half of their spend or half of their revenue on software. So there is a ceiling. How good is your product, there will be a ceiling where they just can't pay more. And that's where I think you need to be creative in two different directions. First interesting direction is if you can add revenue to that SMB, suddenly it changes the whole equation. So I'll give you an example. ServiceTitan, but also many other companies in our portfolio have started to help businesses to grow their top line. So get more leads, get better quality leads, convert better. And obviously, suddenly the argument that you can charge more is easier because you're like, I'm growing your business. So it's not so much I'm a cost line and I'm going to be whatever, 5% of your revenue cost. Actually, if I can increase your revenue, you'll find that SMBs are obviously happier to pay you for that. And so one of my company's amenities, which sells software for hotels, they're investing very much in that direction where if we can generate more bookings for the hotel, we'll take a share on it. But the hotel doesn't think of it as the cost of the software. They just think of it as a percentage margin on that distribution channel you're providing. And so suddenly, you know, you think your ACV is larger, but the hotel doesn't perceive it that way, right? So that's one way you can break that dynamic, break that ceiling. And the second way, I'm sure we're going to talk about it a bit later in the podcast, is obviously embedded finance. Because same thing, if you take a percentage on payments and other flows, it is bigger ACV, but not necessarily perceived by your SMB. And so again, coming back to ServiceTitan, I think 25% of their ARR is from payments. and financial services altogether, which again is not perceived ACV on the customer front. The third axis, which I'm very excited about, is AI. And the reason AI is interesting in that specific conversation is because suddenly you can also replace people cost. And so let me again give an example. I've seen a couple of companies playing around like an AI receptionist. So, you know, if you're a real estate agent or if you're like a doctor's practice, instead of having someone to answer the phone and book bookings, I think now there's pretty good AI voice bots that can do that, at least at least on the weekend off hours, but potentially during the week as well. And suddenly, again, you're not taking from the SaaS budget, but you're taking from the team budget. And that's where, again, coming back to the perceived ceiling of how big an ACV can be, those are all different axes that I think are quite interesting, because suddenly you're not stuck at that, oh, I'm never going to spend much more than this for software, because suddenly you're replacing other buckets.
Yeah, it's the perception of what you're paying for is very different to a SaaS license, like share of additional revenue or like a cost saving, a share of a cost saving. Completely got your point. It's a very interesting thinking here, Lucille. So I think it's very clear that at the end game of building a super successful vertical SaaS company, as you mentioned, you have a multi-product suite. You're doing almost everything from lead gen to, I don't know, accounting, interceptions, API. And probably starting a vertical SaaS is like focusing on a very single repetitive use case, which provides value. In between, you'll probably have a problem of prioritization and like decision-making of where to go next at a multi-product company. So what kind of challenges do you see on this journey from single use case to multi-product company?
Yeah, I'm smiling because that's really where a lot of our time as Series B investors is spent discussing on these boards, because you're absolutely right. Like once you've said that, you still need to execute on it. And there are a lot of questions around which product first. There are also a lot of questions around, do we sell everything upfront? Do we sell as an add-on? Do you need to call customers again? Can you get some sort of PLG where they upsell themselves? Sometimes they don't. And so that's very much the art of the execution. I'm not sure I have like a silver bullet, because it depends so much on customers and so on. But in general, I'll say a couple of things that may sound obvious, but you need to get to know your customers really well. And so you really need to stay close. Well, first of all, because if you want to upsell something else, they need to be very happy with the first product. So again, these are like operating systems, day-to-day usage. You need to be great at it, right? Otherwise, people are like, well, this doesn't even work, let alone I'm not going to give you more of my stack. So you really need to be focused on customer satisfaction. And I think in terms of what next product to build, I would go back to what are the priorities of those businesses. Because I think sometimes it's a bit easy, especially if the team is not from the industry, to think you know. And even for us as investors, right, we're like, oh, that sounds great. We're like, wouldn't it be amazing to do that? And then you talk to people on the ground and they tell you, no, that's definitely not my problem. The problem I have is actually that. And so I've seen that before, where you build something and you realize that that's actually not a priority for your customer base. So I would really stay close to them and have also a lot of this experimental mindset. So that's what I'm trying to tell to a lot of my companies is, also don't make like a big decision, right? Like it's like we spend 6 months thinking about it and then like that's it. We're developing product two. I would always have a bunch of things going on and iterate, right? Like send it to people. The beauty of having a big customer base with thousands and thousands of logos is you can take a few of them and say like, okay, I'm just going to A/B test. If I give you this feature, would you use it? Okay, good. If you use it, would you pay for it? Okay. If you pay for it, how much would you pay for it? And just learn that way, as opposed to trying to be a little bit too top down and saying like, okay, you know, I've looked at all the options and I think HR tech is the next big thing, right? Like I think it's much better to be a little bit more bottom up and pragmatic.
Being close to the customer, I fully agree on. One question I have here is like, have you seen some best practices here, how to set this up in a very structured and organizational approach? For example, are there some, let's say, customer research centers where you really build focus groups of customers, 20 to 50, which you include into every month conversations, identifying the next pain points, then based on these conversations, identifying patterns, and then taking these patterns to product developments? Or is it more like a use by use case? Okay, I have a feeling for my customer base. So is there a kind of best practice in this vertical SaaS play to identify further customer pains?
One thing that, again, may seem obvious, but not everyone does, is I would definitely send product people and engineers to those SMBs, right? So again, talking amenities, and I have another company called Lighthouse in our portfolio doing amazing selling to hotels. Just send them, spend a day, you know, behind the receptionist. Everyone has to be a week, you know, onboarding customers, right? Same thing if you're selling to, you know, hairdressers. I would literally spend time. And it sounds obvious, but I think when companies become bigger, they lose sight of that insight. And that goes such a long way, because then you understand, okay, that's how the day-to-day goes, right? Like, that's how much the person is bothered, or how much the phone is ringing, or how that's how they use the platform. I love these ideas of sometimes, like, you know, every onboarding people have to spend a week there, or, you know, it takes more money, but, you know, at amenities, we always had this joke that at some point we'll buy a hotel ourselves to operate it. We haven't done it yet, but I like the idea, which, you know, maybe like at later rounds, I love the idea of like, that's the best way you're going to learn about the pain points is doing it yourself.
Fully supervised hotels, cameras everywhere, data point collection on every process step. I like the idea. Yeah? It could be like a digital twin of a kind of a hotel or physiotherapy or anything. And then to
physical
build software
experimentation, A/B testing in real life, exactly. Yeah.
Very nice. Maybe one last question to this first block of multi-product and also increasing ACV. So still like, is pricing, because if you create new modules, product extension, you always have the question, okay, do you price them module by module or do you aggregate them to a certain package?
Yeah, so let me tell you, I think pricing is the most underused lever in SaaS. Not only vertical SaaS, by the way. It's really interesting. I think it's a topic that no one talks about, or at least in none of my boards. And I think it's a shame. And when I mean pricing, I mean also packaging. And I mean, you know, what are the packages offered to customers? What's the unit of pricing, right? Do you do per seat? Do you do per room? Do you do per value? Should there be inflation increase every year or not? All these topics, I think, are a bit overlooked. And, you know, it sounds funny, but if you can increase your prices, for example, with inflation 5% every year, that's already 5% of your NR right there, right? Those things have more power than people think. So it's a great topic to be thinking a lot about, and again, A/B testing it. So I'm not sure I have like one single recipe, but I would definitely spend more time thinking about it. I'll give you another example that sometimes, you know, founders don't spend too much time thinking about this. You know, paying upfront versus paying monthly, huge impact on cash flows, right? So you can save yourself a lot of cash burn by asking customers to pay upfront. They might be more committed as well because they've paid for a year, so you reduce churn. And so those things have more impact than people think. I think packaging is another one where, you know, famously, like, you know, it's like when you buy a car, right? Like you put things people don't need in the package, and the things people do need not in the package. I don't know if that's, you know, necessarily like you know, something to replicate, but clearly, if you look at consumer brands, they've been very good at that, right? And in general, I think in B2B we overlook it a little bit, and there's probably a lot you can do, especially when you start upselling, to your point, and having financial products, for example. Do you make it mandatory because you make much more money under financial services, you know, instead of making it a choice? All things like that have more, I think, impact than people think.
Financial services was one thing you mentioned a few times already, Lucille. So I think embedded finance has huge potential for net revenue retention and additional ACV buckets. So taking a look on different models you have seen, different investments, how important is it, and how much potential does it have for a vertical SaaS play?
This is an advertisement. Do you want to grow your SaaS company, but handling payments is painful? Molly makes payments simple and scalable. Molly's flexible solution integrates seamlessly into your platform, opens up new revenue opportunities, and takes the hassle out of onboarding and processing. Here's an example. Stardeck, a SaaS platform for the hospitality industry, used Molly to efficiently manage international payments and enter new markets. The result? Less complexity and overhead, more revenue, and faster growth. Let Molly be your partner for smarter growth. You can find more information at www.molly.com/artist. Molly, that's M-O-L-L-I-E. Molly, more turnover, less effort.
Yeah, I'm hugely excited about embedded finance as an opportunity for vertical SaaS and as a category, full stop. Maybe I can start. I think for listeners, it's interesting also to explain a little bit what that
yes.
is. And I'm happy to give a couple of examples because sometimes it sounds a little bit abstract. It's actually not. So a couple of examples of embedded finance, right? Like the first one is receiving payments, which is an obvious one. So accepting transfers, potentially accepting card payments, over time accepting offline card payments with a POS terminal on the phone. And in some countries, it could be accepting checks. Some people still pay in check, believe it or not, or accepting bills, which I think is a big thing in Germany. That's an obvious place to start because reconciliation is a pain for small businesses. They spend a lot of time trying to understand who paid, who didn't pay, doing the chasing, doing the dunning. And so that's, I think, an obvious place to start where for any software of record, if you can help small businesses making sure they get paid and doing that reconciliation piece, it's a lot of value for the end customer. A second one, and also quite obvious one, is payouts. So again, helping to pay suppliers, helping to automate invoice paying. So when I receive an invoice, I can put a rule to say, can you please pay this one in 30 days so I don't forget, but I don't want to pay it today. Creating these rules, payroll, which is a big one. For example, at the moment, I think the only way people make payroll is extracting a file and then that file goes into the intranet of the bank and make bulk payment, incredibly painful, incredibly clunky. Again, now with embedded finance, you can make that all in one place, pretty easy, real time, very, very different from the banking experience. Other examples is card issuing. And we see a couple of people also going in that direction where you can give cards to your employees to help them spend directly without having the them to like keep the receipts and report back to you. And finally, another one is lending. Toast is a good example there where they offer loans to restaurants and trade finance. And obviously, again, here it's easy to imagine it's a better experience for everyone because obviously Toast has a lot of information on these restaurants. They know exactly how much business is going through, how many payments. And so they're much better place to issue a loan than any external banks. So those are a couple of examples to mention. I think one other thing that's important to understand is all these products, not only they provide a better experience for the end customer, but they generate significant revenue for the software company. And that sometimes people forget because they say like, oh, it sounds like a lot of investment to make reconciliation better. But I'm like, yeah, but you know, it could become half of your revenue, right? So it's not only like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to do automated reconciliation in the software? The financial flows from embedded finance can be pretty meaningful for software companies. They mostly come from two areas. They come from interchange, which is effectively all the card payments that you process, you take a cut on. It can become quite meaningful. The second thing is interest income, which again, if people have deposits on your bank accounts, you get a cut as a software company, you get a cut from the interest income, which for many years was nothing because we've lived in this zero interest rate period. But obviously now, you know, close to 3%, it can add up also quite significantly. And so that's why I think we're going to start seeing a huge wave of embedded finance in the next couple of years, because it's as we were saying in the beginning when talking about ACVs, it's actually a great lever of growth for a lot of these companies.
The question here, I think, this is a little bit the complexity of building these kinds of products into your own suite. And I, based on my knowledge, there's a lot of providers for all of the single use cases explained on the market on the fintech side. So, what is your recommendation here, like? Buying this kind of solutions, white label, integrated to your product, and then provide it to your customers or your portfolio company's customers. Of course, losing probably a significant share of the profit margin. Or is it really something you said, like, hey, we need to build this for ourselves? It's painful at the beginning, but of course, bottom line, it's quite attractive, and also top line, because we get the major share of everything.
I would 100% use an external provider. The good news is you have great companies, for example, like Swan in the market now that are doing this day in, day out. It's very painful to do that yourself. You need to become a regulated institution. You need to have compliance teams in-house. You need to manage customer authentication, KYB. And I think very, very few companies, vertical software companies will do that in-house, not only because of the cost and the type of employees, but also it's not really core, right? So I think the core is to stay a software company and build the best products for your end customers, not necessarily to become a bank. So I would be surprised if many people choose to do that in-house. I think until recently, there wasn't a lot of great banking as a service provider, and it's still a new industry in itself. So you're right, there was a lot of point solutions, right? Card issuing, FX, TransferWise, open banking, which works half of the time. And I think only recently you see this new wave of players, like Swan, like Modular, like a couple of others in Europe that have now gotten to scale and helped a lot of software companies develop that offering. So my sense is that a lot of people will rely on them.
It's quite an interesting business idea to build kind of a vertical SaaS infrastructure player as a service, where you aggregate all the services, like banking, maybe e-signature, maybe payroll, and then provide it to any vertical SaaS place who just build the go-to-market engine on top and maybe single use cases on. It's quite an interesting thought, like building of an kind of an ecosystem for vertical SaaS. But maybe it's existing. Maybe I don't know it.
I think it's massive. Yeah. And if you rethink about business banking for a second, you know, this hasn't evolved. So we've seen the neobanks taking most of the, maybe not most, but at least a significant percentage of consumer banking in the last 10 years. Business banking is still completely terrible, right? The back-end core system of these banks haven't evolved in many, many years. And so if you think about, doing these flows, like moving these flows away from the bank into software players, I could imagine a world where you almost don't use your bank as a business anymore, or maybe just as a place for mortgage and deposits, and even that, right? It's just fundamentally so much easier to do financial flows in your system of record, like in the same place where you manage tables and employees. If you're a restaurant, it's just if you think about it top down, it just makes so much more sense. For many reasons, it took a while and it wasn't really possible before. But if you were building it from scratch, you certainly wouldn't go out of your ERP, log into your extranet of a bank, make payments there, try to reconcile them, then have some stuff on paper, then have an external accountant, then have a different place for taxes, and try to reconcile this whole madness every month, right? Like, you would definitely not build it that way. And so that's why, I think fundamentally, if I was a bank, especially selling to SMBs, I would be worried, because I think a lot of these flows are going to move away. And also, frankly, people are getting more sophisticated, right? So what we were saying around interchange and deposits, I think now people understand. They're like, oh, it seems free to work with, you know, Deutsche Bank, but it's not, because they make money on my deposits and I don't get anything, or they make money on my interchange and I don't get anything. And so I think now people also are getting more educated around what's possible and how much money the bank is making on them. My guess is there will be a lot of change in that space.
Another beauty of vertical SaaS, from my perception, is the power of penetration of a single community. Yeah? So especially if you go in very small subsegments and you manage to create a solution which is perceived valuable, people talk. Yeah. So if you take a contraction side, there are multiple single players working with each other. So if you have a solution which works, word of mouth is great, and community works. And I think also, like, take a look on Hero, they are also planning kind of a big community event, and you also see this in other vertical SaaS places, that conferences, for example, become very important, bringing the community together, and also digital formats. What's your take on community building and the power of community in vertical SaaS places?
I think it's a very cool lever. If we go back to what we were saying at the beginning, where, you know, some of these jobs are, you know, haven't been really sexy, right? You know, you're not invited to the fancy conferences like we do in tech all the time. In general, they're a bit overlooked by society. And I think that's a great opportunity to almost, like, you know, make them sexy again, and highlight just the amazing job these people are doing and how good, you know, how strong these businesses are, right? And change a little bit the perception on small businesses in general. And that's something I feel pretty passionate about, because, you know, it's a big part of our economy. It's a big part of our society. And so almost celebrate the small hotels, the small hairdressers. Also, again, I'm doing a bit of a diversion now, but do we want a world that is ruled by chains and ruled by the booking.coms and the Hiltons and the, you know, restaurant, like, I love them, right? Like, I love Prêt-à-Manger, right? I love this place. But do we want all of that in our, you know, in our cities? Probably not, right? Like, we love the boutique hotels. We love the small restaurants. We love, you know, helping, you know, and working with the small, you know, plumber and carpenter. So I really think it's a cool battle, if you will, to put some light on these businesses and these trades who are doing, you know, usually working very long hours, running very great businesses. And I think that's kind of the opportunity with, you know, the community and where software can potentially play a role to bring this community together and also help them thrive, right? Because they typically don't really compete with each other. So they love sharing best practices. What have you seen? How do you price? How do you deal with this? And so you mentioned Hero is about to launch a big event in person in spring 2025 that they call HeroCon in Dortmund. In our portfolio company Amenities, they do a YouTube channel called The Hotel Club, where they interview hoteliers to share, you know, some topics that they're facing. How do they solve this? What have they seen? And so generally, I love that idea. I think Muse, also in the hotel tech space, has done very well with that. They have their own conference as well every year, which is, again, going back to celebrating those businesses and helping them thrive together effectively.
Is it something you recommend your portfolio companies as a must-have layer later on, because it has so valuable flywheel effects? Or is it something you said, okay, it's nice to have, it helps, it is also, like, of course, helping the communities, the smaller businesses against the big chains, for example? Or is it a must-have to really go later stage and grow?
I think it's a must-have for a couple of reasons. First of all, you really want to be seen as a thought leader in your industry. And so, you know, this positioning makes you more strategic as a company, I think, in general, which is not like, oh, I have built a great business that's X million of ARR selling software, but, you know, I really understood this vertical and I'm bringing innovation and have the pulse of that industry. I think makes you way more strategic and creates more loyalty also from your customers. Second of all, I think it could be very effective way to, you know, to grow. It could be also quite a strong lead generator. if done well. Obviously, you don't want to be sponsoring every single conference with big booths. So you really need to think a little bit about how to do it efficient. But one example I love to quote, and you're not going to like it because it's kind of competitive with artists, but SASTOC, the conference, they have this great idea where they run local events in each geography. Like, you know, they would do SASTOC Paris, regular drinks. And what I think, which is very smart, is they don't run it. They find someone who is like, you know, very well networked, let's say in Paris or in Berlin. And they say, here you go. You have a budget. You have the brand. You go and do an event. Like, we don't need to be there. And for example, that's just a you know, small example, but it's brilliant because you don't have to go. And these people are usually well networked. You make sure you're well aligned, obviously, culturally, and it's professional. But that obviously scales very well, right? And so again, coming back to Hero, amenities, Lighthouse, you could imagine saying, okay, we're going to give small budgets to, you know, regional, well-networked hoteliers and say, hey, why don't you build a little event with 50 other hoteliers in your region? We'll pay for drinks. It's very small expense, right? Like, we're not talking about big budget. You might even find a sponsor, by the way, you know, because other people want to sell to hoteliers. And that scales very nicely, right? So there are ideas like that where you can effectively, you know, find hacks to scale something without you being like organizing. Because obviously that doesn't scale, right? You don't want to organize dinners with, you know, tradespeople and hoteliers all across the country. That's not going to scale. So you need to think a little bit about the hacks. But I think there are a lot of you know, similar ideas like that.
And are there other formats than this physical, let's say, conferences or smaller local events? Let's say where it's like, okay, engaging and like running a community also on a digital perspective makes a lot of sense because you create touch points on a regular basis all year around. Or what's your view here?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. It's funny because we as VCs think a lot about that ourselves as well. Because we have a similar problem, which is, you know, we're investing all across Europe, all across sectors, and we love creating those communities and being thought leaders ourselves. So in a way, we also have that issue. To be very honest with you, in person works so much better. So yeah. I've seen that, for example, like I run webinars sometimes on the topic, let's say vertical SaaS. It's okay. It's nice. You invite founders, you do webinar, you find a great speaker. It's just so much nicer if you do an event. And it's a shame because obviously webinars are way more scalable and you can invite people from all across, you know, regions. So you could have people from Berlin, Paris, and London on the same webinars. However, I find the impact, at least what we found ourselves as investors, is the impact of those is way less than, let's say, do a small dinner with 5 people, 10 people, 10 founders in geography. So I'm afraid I don't have the you know, the silver bullet here where after everyone saying during COVID that everything could be remote, a lot of these things are better in person still.
We as artists agree. I have to say, like, building digital communities or digital touch points, I think it's quite difficult, especially if you're selling to a target group like, for example, Hero, which is very physical and does not have so much airtime on devices or desktops. I think it's not
so easy. Yeah, and there's a big trust element, right? I think you're right. Also, like, you know, after, you know, so many hours in the office, like, do people really want to log into a webinar and be on their screen again? So there's that. And I think there's just a trust element, which, again, is the same for us as investors when we work with founders. There is obviously the thought leadership where you're like, let me tell you why Latrobe is great and all the things we can do for founders. But a lot of it is, okay, but how is going to Lucille be on my board? Can I trust her? Is she going to be around for 10 years? How is she going to behave when things don't work well? And that is so hard to do remotely, right?
Yeah, super hard. I think another point you also mentioned in the article is M&A. And I think I will build a cliffhanger here now because everyone who is interested in this super important level should take a look on your article. I think it's quite important to build multi-products. You can do acquisitions for acquiring kind of other product segments. You can do acquisitions in terms of expanding to a new market or just buying in ARR. I highly recommend taking a look on Lucille's article, which we, of course, put to the show notes here. I have to say, thank you for this great conversation so far. So I think I learned a lot of new stuff about vertical SaaS, and I could continue this conversations for hours, to be very honest, because it's also one of my passion topics.
Thanks so much for having me, Julius.
I will not leave you alone so easy, let's say, because we need one very important recommendation from you, which is a great place to enjoy food or beverage in London. So anything you would recommend to our artist community, if they are in London, maybe also for a talk with you, where should they go afterwards?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough one because I'm French, but ooh, this yeah. is Italian food. so I have to give this one to the Italians. I love this place called River Cafe. Uh-huh. It's in West London alongside the Thames. In the summer, they have tables out and it's just a really beautiful place. So it's on the pricey side. So I would keep that for a closing dinner or a celebration, but definitely recommend checking it out.
So I'm waiting for a picture of you, Lucia, with the next German founder, which closed a financing round with 8Roads here. Thanks a lot for taking the time. This morning was my big pleasure. And yeah, hopefully see you around in October for the next Artist Summit.
We'd love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, everyone, for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed and took some valuable learnings for your SaaS business with you. My name is Julius Gunner, and I say thank you for taking the time joining us today at Artist on Air. If you have some feedback, if you have wishes, if you have like a target list for us, please let us know. Contact me at julius@artist.net or just DM me a message on LinkedIn. Thanks a lot. Happy building. See you next week. Bye-bye.